My name's John Lennox, and I'm a retired professor of mathematics at the University of Oxford, and I'm the author of a book called 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity.
John, so great to see you. Thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
It's a great pleasure to be with you today.
I wish we could be face to face, but hey, we're together by Zoom over about 5,000 miles, but you're looking well.
Well, thank you very much. I'm a real Zoombie, so this is another go.
Isn't this a great technology?
Fantastic technology. I'm so delighted. In fact, over the past lockdown years, I've done about 500 of these, and that's kept me at home, and I've been able to write books. So that book is partially a product of this.
Of the COVID pandemic. It's great that something good has come out of the pandemic.
Yes.
Well, first of all, for those who don't know you, who is John Lennox?
Well, John Lennox is originally a lad from a very tiny country, Northern Ireland, and grew up in difficult days, actually. That was the beginning of sectarian violence, and had wonderful parents because, although they were Christian, they didn't force their faith down my throat. Mm. They loved me enough to allow me to come to my own conclusions. But one of the most remarkable things, I think, about them, David, was that in a sectarian situation, they weren't sectarian. And that was costly. My father ran a kind of country store with 30, 40 employees, sold everything.
Wow.
And he employed in a very divided city and country, as equally as he could, Protestants and Catholics. And that cost, well, the business was bombed several times. My brother was nearly killed in a terrorist attack. And I once said, Dad, why do you do this? And he said, look, he said, the biblical view is all men and women, no matter what they believe, are made in the image of God. And I intend to treat them like that. Wow. And that's one of the most important things I came away with from my childhood. First of all, you're free to think, and they encouraged me to read other worldviews other than Christian. And secondly, the dignity of everybody, even if you disagree with them. And those two principles have lived with me and shaped me. And I left school, went to Cambridge, studied maths, and I've had a career in mathematics and most of my life as well in philosophy of science. I started Bible teaching in my 20s and only started writing books later in my 40s or so. But I've been passionately concerned with the what we might call the intellectual defense of Christianity. Mm. I remember listening to C.S. Lewis in Cambridge, and he set that kind of compass for my life.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your book, 2084. Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. Well, the title. I mean, tell us about the title. We got this 2084.
It's quite amusing because I owe the title to a fierce and very famous intellectual atheist at the University of Oxford here. He's a physical chemist, and we were traveling together to do a debate in the University of Southampton. And we were on opposite sides, of course, of the debate. And we agreed in the car. He asked, could he have a lift with me? And I said, sure, Peter, you come with me. And he said, we're not going to talk about the debate. So, John, he said, what are you writing? And I said, actually, Peter, I'm writing a book on artificial intelligence. And quick as flash, he said, I've got a title for you. I said, what's that? He said, 2084. I said, that's terrific. If I use it, I will acknowledge you. And he is acknowledged at the beginning of the book.
I remember reading
and
that.
It was a brilliant title because it encapsulates a lot of what I wanted to say. Because, of course, the kind of predictions that George Orwell made in 1984 are all more or less with us today. The idea of universal surveillance and all the pluses and minuses that that brings with it. And it formed a very good background, and the echo and response to the book around the world, and it's now in quite a few languages, has been wonderful. So I'm very grateful to him, though he fights me like cats and dogs. Your audience may love to watch a debate between him and me that really is feisty. And all they have to do is Google dueling professors.
Dueling professors, and they'll find you on YouTube. Oh, that's terrific. So what would you say the big idea of your book is? What's driving it?
Well, the big idea is I've been interested in AI to a certain extent and read a bit about it. But what I noticed was it was raising questions in thoughtful minds, and particularly in thoughtful Christian minds, as to what implications does this have for our understanding of what it means to be a human being? And of course, AI has two parts. There's the stuff that works, narrow AI, a system that does one thing that normally requires human intelligence to do. And we're familiar with that, like a surveillance camera or picking out a criminal in a crowd and so on. Mm-hmm. But of course, the sci-fi people and others, much more serious people, are interested in the more heady kind of, let's try to create an artificial intelligence that can do everything that humans can do and a lot more. In other words, let's try and create a super intelligence. And I noticed there was a lot of discussion about this kind of thing. And what if we do that? Will it be conscious? And what does it mean for us as humans? And who are we anyway? And the motivation for the book, David, was very simple. A group of thinking Christians in London were having a big conference, and they wanted me to introduce it with a discussion on the biblical concept of what is a human being. In other words, what does it mean to say that we bear the image of God? What does that actually mean? And I first refused. I said, I don't know enough about AI. But they said, well, we're not asking you. We're asking you about Genesis. But then I started to read, and I saw immediately, no, this needs a lot of thought. And that's how the book arose.
So when people think about artificial intelligence, they're really are a lot of manifestations of that in our lives already, right? But as you said earlier, and as you indicate in the book, these are systems that can do one thing and just one thing usually, and do it well because they're able to crunch so much data.
So that's correct.
Where do we see AI in our lives these days?
Well, I think what you've just said is hugely important, that we split the thing into two. There's narrow AI and what's often called general AI. And narrow AI is the stuff that's being used all over the place and it works. Take, for example, medical diagnostics. They'll take maybe a million x-ray pictures of human lungs, and they get the best doctors in the world to label them with the diseases. And then I get something wrong with my lungs. My x-ray is fed into this, and the algorithm, the computer software, will compare the picture of my lungs with those million pictures. And with a split second, it'll say, well, your picture, the nearest match is that one, and that's the disease. And that disease will probably be the disease I've got, and the diagnosis would be more accurate than any local hospital could give. And that's being rolled out all over the place. Mm. Another area is cameras, and police forces are grateful for cameras that can recognize criminals. So that's plus the downside of that, and this is where ethical problems begin, is that, as we know from some parts of the world like Xinjiang and China, that the surveillance is so intense with these recognition cameras that it's used to suppress an ethnic minority. So you get into this business about the policing of AI, controlling the ethics of it. And this is a huge topic. And our problem in the world today is that the technology is advancing much more rapidly than the ethics that should be there to control it.
So who are the people who should be at the table discussing this and talking about the ethical aspects of these advances in AI? from your point of view?
Well, let's start small. I encourage intelligent people, particularly Christians, because they have an ethical worldview. But anybody in that sense with a strong ethical base, because after all, when you look around the world, the strong ethically based people have a great deal in common. They may have slightly different reasons for their ethical system, why they believe it. Mine is because it is the biblical one, and I think God stands behind it, and it's part of his image. But people may agree with me for other reasons on the dignity of human beings. So we can start there. We need people, articulate people like that, who know the science but are sitting at the table. And personally, I've encouraged many young Christians who are gifted in science not to be afraid of this stuff, but to go into it and make the contribution at the level of technology and also at the level of ethics. And one of the greatest examples of that at the moment is your very own Professor Ros Picard of MIT. She's doing fantastic work on autistic children, developing facial recognition systems that tell if they're going to have an episode. And she's invented a smartwatch that you can buy nowadays that will predict that happening.
Wow.
And she is a wonderful example of doing absolutely first-rate medical work. But as a Christian, in Oxford recently, at one of the most prestigious lectures in our university, I was quite touched by it. I was there. She said, we've got to somehow have a value system behind this, and we need an overarching principle. And so I want to introduce this principle. We all waited, and up on the screen came the words in Latin, Imago Dei, the image of God.
Wow.
And that was something to do in the University of Oxford, you know.
Right.
And what was so encouraging is that in the response speeches that were made, it's a completely secular situation, but one speech was made by a brilliant Christian, a world authority on electronics, and another by, I believe, someone who doesn't have any religious faith, both supporting her that we needed this kind of thing. So that is a wonderful example of something that just happened a few weeks ago here in Oxford.
Well, that's terrific. And does that make that into your book? Does that story come into your book as well?
No. It comes in the next edition.
Ah, okay.
So I should tell people that I've learned, too late, but I have learned that some fields are moving so fast that books need updating constantly. And my publishers are aware of the fact that I am constantly writing stuff for that book. And it's now 50% longer than it was. But there won't be a new one for 2 or 3 years.
I mean, takes that's a while to get the book
current.
Yeah.
And that's got the basic stuff in it. It's just that there's new stuff and there's new thinking, and I want to be up with it.
Well, one of the things that comes across in your work is that there are limits to science, that there are limits to this artificial intelligence. In fact, the word intelligence almost seems misput. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's really intelligence. It's a function, but there's not, I don't think, intelligence behind it, is there?
No, and this is important. There's a wonderful paper written by an elderly pioneer in artificial intelligence. He rejoices in the name of Professor Joseph Ray Melichamp from the University of Alabama. And he wrote a paper years ago with the title, The Artificial, that is the word artificial, in the phrase artificial intelligence is real. In other words, it's not real intelligence. The machine is not intelligent any more than a rock is. And our problem is this, that in human beings, God has created us connecting intelligence with consciousness. Now, the leaders, the world leaders in AI, and I'm referring to people like Peter Norvig, who's contributed to the AI Bible, really. It's a huge work on artificial intelligence. They are completely open, and they say, look, we are not trying to create a conscious machine. All we need is the simulation of intelligence. In other words, as you put it a few moments ago, that our system will do what is what normally requires human intelligence to do, and do it at more and more levels. But it itself is not intelligent in any sense, but we call it intelligent because it simulates intelligence. And of course, that's risky because we use all kinds of terms in there and we treat these things as if they were intelligent. You just want to watch a group of bishops talking to a baby robot to see what I mean. They start patting it. Oh, you dear little thing, and all this kind of stuff. It's absolutely incredible. I know of an incident where that happened, which is why I'm mentioning it. The attribution of intelligence, and we use words like machine learning and so on. But no, your computer is not thinking. It's just crunching numbers.
Exactly, exactly. One of the things about the Imago Dei, and one of the things that come across, you talked about consciousness a moment ago, and then the idea of soul suggests itself to me. And I have a friend who's a biologist who's convinced, and is a Christian. She says that eventually we'll discover something in the material world that is what we would call a soul.
Yeah.
Do you see it that way, or do you think the soul and consciousness is something beyond our brains, beyond our minds?
Well, I do, certainly, because ultimate reality is not material in the first place. As far as theology goes, God is spirit. But approaching it from a scientific perspective, I found very illuminating, because we live in the information age, and information, even informally understood, is carried on material, but it isn't itself material. And here's the, seems to be the intellectual death blow to materialism as a philosophy, in that information does not appear to be reducible to a material substrate. It's something different. It's fundamental. And the big debate and tension within academia is really between two worldviews. And the naturalistic or atheistic or even materialistic worldview says that there is nothing beyond the material. But I want to say that you'd have to reject part of science if you go down that. And you see, if you look at it this way, one of the most marvelous statements to my mind comes at the beginning of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word. And he makes the statement then, all things came to be through the Word. That's the actual translation of the Greek. It's mm-hmm. not quite all things were made by him, although that's true. It's all things came to be. It's an existence statement.
Mm-hmm.
And the big debate is, in our world, what is ultimate reality? Is it material, or the quantum vacuum, or something like that? Or is it a non-material reality, mm-hmm. such as God? And you see, even within science now, we're coming to see that the immaterial is more important than the material. So
wow.
I feel there's a pointer coming from science that makes great sense of that statement, in the beginning was the Word. So as a scientist, I affirm that very strongly.
Wow. Well, we would love for people to come out and buy your book, 2084, Artificial Intelligence and the Future of Humanity. John Lennox, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
I'm pleased to be with you, and there's a whole video guide with that book as well.
All right. We'll put that in the show notes for everybody so that they can find that. That's wonderful. John, hope you'll come back and be with us on another topic one day.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Stick around for just a nugget of wisdom from John Lennox that's coming up and at the very end of the podcast. Really terrific stuff. Helped me to hear it, and I'm sure it'll help you. One of the reasons I love doing these podcasts is because I get a chance to speak to some incredible people. For more info about him and our other guest on other podcasts, check the show notes always. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Comment, rate us, whatever you want to do. We'd love to hear from you. I want to thank those who are responsible for making this podcast possible. Jocelyn Solis, Janet Seifert, Kathy Capes, and thanks especially to Phil Cady for our music. Really appreciate you listening, and 168 hours, we'll be back with another podcast.
A long time ago, when I was much younger, I used to think, I will solve all the problems of life, and then at the age of 30, I'll begin to live. And an older and much wiser academic said to me, "You've got it all wrong. Solving the problems of life is living." That has helped me enormously in all the years right until today.